Welcome, everyone. I'm Robin Proud. I have the honor to be one of the rotating speakers here. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. And I'm really happy to be here at a time we've been waiting for a long time. It's a great joy that Park Hall will be one of the first places that people can gather together. About a year ago or a little more, there were some touching messages. There's a picture I saw of a movie theater called The World, and underneath they had put on their marquee, "The world is closed." There was another movie theater that put, "See you on the other side," and sometimes it seemed like we would never get there. And the quotation is a little bit longer than what fits on there. From Stacey Abrams, effective leaders must be truth seekers. And that requires a willingness to understand truths other than our own. Okay, I have just a few sentences reading here from A Black Woman's History of the United States. Black women's history in its truest sense serves as a historic roadmap of the failures of mainstream approaches to democracy and an incisive tutorial on how to correct it. Among the most oppressed and marginalized, Black women in the United States have nonetheless routinely defied otherwise near all-encompassingly negative messages, denying their right to be, to push back, and demand more from the nation, from their communities, from their partners, and from themselves. As the centennial of women's suffrage approached, which would be August 2020, New York City and Central Park planned a monument. There were multiple statues of men in the park. There were some sculptures by women artists, and there were some representations of allegorical women. There was Mother Goose, but there were no statues of actual women. The original design for the sculpture showed Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony standing near a scroll showing the names of 22 other women suffragists. The scroll contained the names of several Black women, such as Sojourner Truth, Mary Church Terrell, and Ida B. Wells. Immediate objections stated that the design made it look like Stanton and Anthony were standing on the other women. The sculptor removed the scroll from the design. The remaining sculpture of the two leaders was then criticized as a lily-white version of history. There was also a concern about Susan B. Anthony's deliberate use of racism to advance women's rights to vote over those of Black men. For the final version, then, the artist added Sojourner Truth as a participant so that the three women are talking around the table. So this is what the statue actually looks like with Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Now, over the years, I've spoken to you about a number of women involved in the fight for women's suffrage. There was Margaret Fuller, who wrote in the 1830s that women should not only vote, but serve in political office. Sadly, she died before the fight really got started. There were women that were more known for other achievements, like Julia Ward Howe and Louisa May Alcott, but who also fought for women's rights. And last year, I introduced someone from the next generation, Helen Hamilton Gardner, who was present at the signing of the 19th Amendment. These women came from different areas of the country and different levels of wealth or poverty. They were all largely self-taught because higher education wasn't available for them. They were Unitarian, Universalist, or Freethinkers. But one other thing they had in common was that they were white. Now, considering where I was coming from, this isn't a surprise. In the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries, Unitarian Universalism and its predecessors have been and continue to be overwhelmingly white. When Susan B. Anthony wrote her definitive history of women's suffrage, she wrote the history of white women. But before the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention, here's Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who are regularly recognized. But before the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention and after the ratification of the 19th Amendment, Black women in large numbers worked for the vote for themselves and everyone else. This history is well detailed in two recent books, where I took my title from this one, Vanguard: How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All by Dr. Martha S. Jones, and for young adults, Lifting as We Climb, Black Women's Battle for the Ballot Box by Yvette Dion. And this one is more in a kind of graphic format with a lot of inserts and images and so on. So today I'll tell you a bit about the contribution of Black women to the democratic bedrock of our country. When I first thought about this topic, I thought, I'm not the right person to speak about this. This isn't my history. But then I remembered some of the messages that we got last year, stating that Black people are tired of explaining history to white people, and that's the job of white people to educate ourselves. So what I'm presenting today comes largely from these books by contemporary Black women. I also used No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Women by Estelle B. Friedman, A Black Women's History of the United States by Dana Remy Berry and Callie Nicole Gross. And I will send these. I said last time that I would put the name of the book that I used in the chat. I never did. So I will send all these to Fritz. From early in our country's history, Black women fought against slavery. Of course, that was the most basic right. Elizabeth Freeman took on that name in 1781 when she won a court case in Massachusetts on the grounds that the Constitution of that state outlawed slavery. But from the beginning, Black women had to confront limits imposed on them both by white society and by Black men. The modern term of intersectionality, that is, the intertwining of various prejudices, such as racism and sexism, this was just daily life to these women. In 1832, Mariah Miller Stewart was the first woman in America to address an audience of mixed gender and race on the topic of abolition. Some free Blacks criticized that as unwomanly. But she asked in 1833, "What if I am a woman?" She cited biblical women as her precedent. And often free Black women founded and ran their own associations and clubs to avoid male domination. Now, most of the women I've researched for you left traditional churches as their thinking evolved or their leadership wasn't welcomed. For Black women, this wasn't the case. For Black women, churches were their home and the crucible of their leadership. It wasn't just that their faith or even the community that sustained them was there, but the fact that these were spaces where they could lead. Black women raised funds, organized events, solicited and supervised volunteers. They did what we would call networking. Sometimes their aspirations conflicted with the expectations of the church. In the 18th century, Jerina Lee insisted that she was called by God to speak in church, to preach. And after a long struggle, her talent allowed her to do so. Mary Ann Shadd was a free Black woman who, like many others in the years before the Civil War, moved to Canada. There she founded the abolitionist weekly newspaper, the Provincial Freeman, which was not a common thing for a woman to organize a newspaper. One of the women featured in Shadd's paper was Sojourner Truth. Truth cut a dramatic figure standing 6 feet tall. She often dressed elaborately in order to reinforce her status as a woman to be respected. And her famous line is, "Ain't I a woman?" Sojourner Truth was the first Black woman to attend a National Women's Convention that was in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1850. And from then on, there was always some conversation among white women about whether the inclusion of someone like Truth was a distraction or even a detriment to their basic message of women's rights. Last year, when I spoke to you about fiction in the 50 years before women got the vote, I mentioned one Black novelist, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. She wrote both poetry and prose and lectured on the abolitionist circuit in the 1850s. And when I saw her come up again in this research, I was happy to recognize her. But it wasn't until a couple weeks ago in the latest UU World that I realized she was a Unitarian. I think this is an example of bias on my part. I knew she lived in New England. If she had been a white woman, I would have looked further to see if she was connected with Unitarian circles there, and it never dawned on me to do that. So I will be back to tell you more about her in the future. All of this time studying Unitarian women in history, she has been invisible. But today I'll introduce her briefly. Like Sojourner Truth, Harper deliberately presented herself as ladylike. Her manner was described as unassuming, yet her rhetoric was sharp and effective. Her feminine qualities were no protection as she traveled around the country. Railroad conductors tried to eject her from waiting rooms, telling her to wait outside. Or they tried to remove her from the ladies' carriage and sent her to the baggage car, although she had paid the full fare. Threats and rowdy mobs were a regular obstacle to Harper and others on the speaking circuit. Probably the most famous quote by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper is, "We are all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity." Dr. Martha Jones, author of the book Vanguard, says of this quote, "It was a fierce reframing of American politics that rejected differences of race and sex," when she said, "We are all bound together in one great bundle of humanity." What she did not say also mattered, and Harper did not speak about property rights or the ballot. Instead, her grievances emanated from the everyday indignities Black women endured on the nation's streetcars, where Harper had been roughed up, ridiculed, and refused service. All this while white women watched. She said, "You white women speak of rights, I speak of wrongs." And just as an aside, I was struck by the long, difficult history of traveling while Black. In the 19th century, trains, streetcars, and steamboats were the scene of harassment and violence. In the 20th century, it was interstate buses and city buses, and even today, private cars. In 1862, Harper spoke up about President Lincoln's initial draft of the Emancipation Proclamation. His original plan was to send the freed slaves to Liberia, Canada, and other countries. After the war, she traveled hundreds of miles a year speaking on the promise of Reconstruction. And Dr. Jones says, she believed that when Black women's dignity was respected, so too would be the dignity of all people. Harper was uniformly praised as a speaker. And after the war, she attended the 1866 National Rights Convention, where she was appointed to the Finance Committee. Based on her own experience, she explained that legal rights were not enough to end the daily conflicts and humiliation endured by Black women. During and after the Civil War, free Black women from the North and South worked as nurses, teachers, and relief workers. Harriet Jacob, writer of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, which was her memoir, she worked in the South after the war and wrote for the newspaper, The Liberator, describing the plight of refugees, which is a word I have not thought of in relation to the Civil War, refugees. In 1863, she went back to New York to attend a meeting of the Women's National Loyal League. This meeting featured Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and the abolitionist Angelina Grimke. Jacobs was the one who opened the meeting with a prayer to save the nation and free the slave. She served on the League's executive board. So some Black women did have positions of power, yet in histories of the women's movement, they're basically invisible. In her work in the South, Jacobs had to overcome objections by both Black and white women, Black and white men to lead a school for refugee children. Now, as you probably know, there was a period of Reconstruction when some Black men were able to vote and even hold office. But women weren't idle at this time. They led political meetings, helped educate men, and watched out for intimidation at the polls. And they continued to press for women's rights. Eliza Ann Gardner had grown up in Boston before the Civil War. She excelled in school and avidly followed activist leaders, getting to know William Lloyd Garrison, Frederick Douglass, and Sojourner Truth. Her home was known as a haven for fugitive slaves. She was called the Julia Ward Howe of her race. Like Julia Ward Howe, she fought for both abolition and women's rights, but her main fight was within her own AME Zion Church. She stressed how important the work of women had been to the church and demanded full rights to speak and lead. Her work actually led to a revision of denominational practices so that women could attend conferences and become preachers. These women preachers insisted that Black Christianity, which stressed the equality of races, must also stand for the equality of the sexes. And there were two early women ministers, were Julia Foote and Mary Small. With this new power, Dr. Jones states, AME Zionist activist women moved nimbly between sacred and secular circles, cross-fertilizing each with ideas about their rights, including the capacity to vote and hold office. These were not women who made stark choices between the pulpit and a temperance hall, or between missionary society fundraising and a club movement convention. Just as political debates informed their religious deliberations, women's work in churches was a route to rights consciousness, an occasion for honing arguments, and a proving ground for their capacities for leadership, governance, and even political wrangling. In this, there was power. One of the best known Black women of the late 19th and early 20th century was Ida B. Wells Barnett. She was born into slavery during the Civil War. After the war, her parents were active in Reconstruction politics and encouraged her education. However, she was expelled after a dispute with the university president. Now that sounds like an interesting story to look further into. When she was 16, her parents died of yellow fever and she had to teach to support her siblings. In 1884, Wells filed a lawsuit against a railroad company that had thrown her off the train even though she had a ticket. She won the case at the local level, but it was overturned in federal court. After the murder by lynching of a friend, Ida Wells took up the scourge of lynching as a campaign. These lynchings were often justified by claims of crimes by the Black victims. Wells Barnett investigated and wrote newspaper columns and a pamphlet. As you might imagine, this didn't go over well locally. Local people burned her press and issued so many violent threats that she left Memphis and moved to Chicago. In Chicago, she and other Black leaders called for a boycott of the Columbian Exposition, which was the Chicago World's Fair. They accused the organization of excluding African Americans. In 1895, Ida married the well-known Black lawyer Ferdinand Burnett. They had four children, but this didn't stop Ida's activism. She traveled internationally, speaking about lynching. This wasn't a message welcomed by most of the white suffragist groups. Ida Wells Barnett was a founder of the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. Now, Black women's clubs were a unique and powerful structure for decades. In the era of Jim Crow, along with the founding of the NAACP in 1909, the club movement took off across the country. In some ways, Black women had more freedom of association than Black men. A gathering of Black men might have been seen as a threat, but Black women, often meeting at church, were practically invisible. Many of the leaders of this group, National Association of Colored Women, NACW, many of them were descended from slaves, but had been educated either at Black colleges or at Oberlin, famous as a pioneer in interracial education. At the founding of the NACW in 1905, there were nearly 200 local clubs across the country. By 1924, its membership was close to 100,000 women. Their motto was "Lifting as we climb." The first president of the NACW was Mary Church Terrell. In her speech, The Progress of Colored Women, she explained that while Black women shared a history with white women such as Susan B. Anthony or Lucy Stone, they had specific concerns. She said, "Our peculiar status in this country seems to demand that we stand by ourselves." Terrell led the organization in combating lynching, working for civil rights, and for the vote. Terrell herself had had a privileged upbringing and a degree from Oberlin. She was part of what W.E.B. Du Bois called the talented 10th. And as we see here, she looked much less stereotypically Black than, say, Sojourner Truth. Terrell was the first Black woman to serve on a school board for the District of Columbia. She launched an early civil rights organization, the National Afro-American Council, and directed its anti-lynching bureau. She wrote for Black readers, but also for white audiences, for instance, in the Washington Post. Through it all, she had to balance the expectations of the still Victorian attitudes of the public. When she spoke in Washington, D.C. on suffrage, the journal, The Colored American, felt the need to reassure its readers. They wrote, "Mrs. Terrell sacrifices not one iota of her womanly graciousness, and her charming and stately attractiveness is not diminished one degree by the position she takes on this vital question." Although racism was common in the white suffrage movement, Terrell never hesitated to work with white women's organizations when it was beneficial. She even traveled to Europe in 1904 and addressed the World's Conference of Women. Although some within the Black women's movement balked at openly fighting for suffrage, Terrell won the day and established a women's suffrage department within the NACW. Terrell also addressed the issue of limited career opportunities for Black women, saying, "It matters not what my intellectual attainments may be or how great is the need of the services of a competent person. If I try to enter many of the numerous vocations in which my white sisters are allowed to engage, the door is shut in my face." When the 19th Amendment passed in 1920, Jim Crow was in full flower throughout the South. Poll taxes, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, and out-and-out terrorism squelched many attempts to vote by Black citizens. Black women leaders petitioned Alice Paul and other national white women to continue the fight until all women could vote, but the white organization declared its battle won and closed down. As ever, it was up to Black women to demand the nation deliver on its promises. Black women organized educational events to teach women about the issues and about their rights. In some places in the South, they succeeded in registering to vote. This led to alarm and further restrictions. When Black women came in to register, they were directed to wait in line all day. At the end of the day, none of them had been served. They were told to come again the next day or in 2 weeks, when the same drama would be reenacted. This was the era when the lost cause and the supposedly gallant acts of the Confederacy were being enshrined in monuments throughout the South. One of these, proposed in 1922 by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, was to be of a Black mammy cradling a white infant. The head of the National Association of Colored Women, or NACW at this time, was Hallie Quinn Brown. She wrote about this monument: "Slave women were brutalized, the victims of white man's caprice and lust. Often the babe torn from her arms was a child of her oppressor." And she denounced the hypocrisy of those who, in one generation, held the Black mammy in abject slavery, and in the next would erect a monument to her fidelity. "White Southern women would do better," she said, "to make restitution by stopping their husbands and fathers from lynching and other violence." To prove that Black women were fit to vote, Brown collaborated with more than 25 other women to produce a book, Homespun Heroines and Other Women of Distinction. This book, published in 1926, included 60 biographical sketches along with essays and poems. It told the truth about enslaved women, including some who had escaped or purchased freedom for themselves and their families. And we'll just look briefly at a few key figures from the early to mid 20th century. Jane Bolin became the first Black woman elected to a state legislature in Pennsylvania. She was also the first Black woman to graduate from Yale Law School. As we learned earlier, Mary McLeod Bethune, we don't have her picture again, founded the National Council of Negro Women. Jessie DePriest, the wife of the only Black member of Congress in 1929. I love the outfit here. She was reluctantly invited to the White House by Herbert Hoover's wife, Lou, only after careful planning of which white ladies would be open to meeting her. Nannie Helen Burroughs, in 1925, became president of the National League of Republican Colored Women. She also led an interracial gathering where white women participated under her leadership. And of course, at this time, it was the Republican Party that was the more natural home for Black voters. Something I hadn't thought about before reading this book was that the New Deal programs under Franklin Roosevelt almost exclusively helped white people. The National Recovery Act offered jobs first to white people and only low-level jobs to Black workers. Agricultural programs didn't include sharecroppers or tenant farmers, which the majority of Black farmers were. Social Security, you may know, excluded agricultural and domestic workers who were overwhelmingly Black. On the other hand, civil service offered colorblind entry into decent jobs in places like Washington, D.C. And the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, allied publicly with Black women. Now, many of you are familiar with the intense and essential contributions of Black women to civil rights for all after the Second World War. Not only Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King, but others who are lesser known. Constance Baker Motley was the first Black woman to serve as a federal judge. Sorry, Fannie Lou Hamer was an activist who challenged not only Jim Crow, but the National Democratic Party, which at the time still included many of the Southern Dixiecrats. Diane Nash was a freedom rider and founder of the Southern Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. Pauli Murray was the first Black woman to earn a doctorate in law and the first to be an Episcopal priest. And Shirley Chisholm was a U.S. representative and a serious presidential candidate in 1972. And one of the recent heirs to this tradition is Stacey Abrams. I was thrilled to learn recently that Stacey Abrams will be giving the Ware Lecture this year. That's the keynote address at the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly. Because that's virtual, this event will be available to anyone who registers, and probably this lecture will be viewable afterwards. The work of Stacey Abrams in the last 10 years is the inheritance of so many Black women, those I've mentioned and many others whose names we will never know. Some of these women's names were invoked by Vice President Kamala Harris in her acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention last year. I've sometimes used the saying that Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards in high heels. Well, with the Black women, it's as if they had to dance barefoot with someone stepping on their feet. But every time Black women won a battle for voting rights, employment, or just to be safe in their own communities, they moved our nation in the direction of our aspirations. They benefited not only their own race or gender, but all of us. Well, thank you, everyone. I do have our closing words are quite short here from Shirley Chisholm. If they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair.